Always grateful to have artists like Scott and Mallory. Scott, I hope it's okay. I'm going to move this over here just like this. Perfect. It's rare to have artists that so nail the... that can put words to the types of dichotomies that we wrestle with when we come out of faith backgrounds that we've deconstructed from or no longer serve us, and then we're trying to figure out what to do with these new traditions, these new holidays in light of that. I really, really appreciate the Rough and Tumble for their lyrics. I'm also jealous of just their overall vibe. Like, I'm looking at this case up here, and it looks like something that I would buy at a shop just to put on a display shelf because it just, like, fits this really cool aesthetic and vibe. So I really enjoy them. I'm looking forward to seeing them play that album, songs from that album tonight because, I've been a big fan of that since it came out. It really connected with me. I'm sorry that we are taking on such a heavy-to-tackle subject, but to be fair, when is the best time of year to talk about this, right? So we were talking about this a little bit in pre-talk. So, you know, we've been talking about the idea of doing a series around death and dying for at least a year now, and have talked about what elements we want to have, the types of speakers we want to have, and the things that we want to address. Obviously, you don't talk about it in the middle of summer, right? Nobody wants to hear about dying in the middle of summer. You know, we're all doing our things, going to the lake, you know. And we don't want to do it in the middle of the holidays, and we don't want to do it in the dead of winter. Nobody can handle talking about death in the dead of winter, right? So we're like, okay, this is kind of as good of a spot as we can fit in there. And we kind of like carved out this time in the speaking calendar. And it's really amazing how much life just kind of conspires to weave together these things into something that you don't really anticipate. So this series is called Memento Mori. It's a phrase that I have loved and adopted for years. It's a Latin phrase, Stoic reminder. So the early Stoics, this was said by Roman generals before battles. It was adopted by thinkers like Marcus Aurelius and Seneca, these early what we would consider Stoics or the birth of the Stoicism type of philosophy. And they were fond of saying, memento mori, remember you must die, remember your mortality, don't forget you're going to die. And that was just part of one side of a coin, because it would also be joined with memento vivere, remember to live. And that those two things were seen as inextricably bound together, that death is very much a natural part of life. And that talking about death, contemplating your own mortality, is a very healthy thing to do. It cultivates some very deep appreciation for life. Now, this subject has taken on an especially deep meaning for me. So I come from a background as a pastor, and I've been both by bedsides of those who were dying within congregations, within people that were friends or would reach out to me, or family that we've had to deal with. So I've become more comfortable with the idea of death, and I embrace talking about it. I embrace the experience, and every death I've had the privilege to witness, and I do consider it a privilege, it felt to me, and it was a sacred moment. I don't know if you've had the opportunity to, and not every death is what we would consider to be beautiful or maybe even sacred. It may feel traumatic, and I've experienced those kinds of deaths too. But even in those moments, there is a very real contemplation of mortality that comes. If you have ever had a near-death experience, if you've ever had a cancer diagnosis, or anything that put your future in jeopardy, you know what comes out of that as you begin to contemplate your own mortality. Lisa's dad, as some of you know, has been on about a three-month journey since he received a cancer diagnosis of a lymphoma. He was on the other side of the state. Lisa had traveled back and forth to help her parents with that transition, and then we were ultimately deciding to bring him over to this side of the state to pursue treatment if possible. They moved him over here a few weeks ago now, and shortly after we moved him in, we had his first oncology appointment, and it was determined that the cancer had progressed far enough that any type of chemotherapy or surgery wasn't an option. And so we chose hospice care. We chose an in-home hospice treatment. And we rented a house nearby in Holland. We have, as a family, had traumatic deaths in homes that home is then marked with that moment. And that becomes a consideration. So we wanted a safe place that was a comfortable place for him to enjoy these final weeks. And so we had this house in North Holland that we were able to rent. And I could not be more grateful for how this time progressed, because during these past few weeks, he's been able to see family as he's wanted to, sometimes only for short stretches. He's been lucid the entire time. And we've had incredible, incredible time with him as he's been able to face his own mortality. And yesterday morning, Lisa called me. I was up here at our site, and she said that overnight he had taken a turn for the worse. And so when I got there, he was non-responsive, and he passed last night around 7:30. And that is the response that many of us would have when we hear of somebody's dying. And it's obviously a normal one to have. On the other hand, we recognize and know that we've been looking forward to this moment for months and then weeks, and then in the last week, within days, knowing that that's coming. As I've spent time with death, I can see the markers and learn to recognize, as others who have worked with it even further, such as those in palliative or hospice care, can recognize even better. But you recognize the signs of the end and what that looks like. But I'm appreciative that there are so many types of death to be had. Before Gary passed, this was about, I think, 2 days ago now, and time gets a little bit fuzzy as you think back on these last weeks when you spend with someone. He asked me, because he was a pastor, a retired pastor, and I'm a former pastor. And he asked me, he's like, "Brad, what do you think it's going to be like?" And I said, "The death, the dying process? Yeah." And I said, "I don't know. I don't know, Gary. I know that you and I have seen probably more deaths than the average person. And so you and I know that there are a lot of ways to die. Some of them can seem more pleasant and seem like the type that we want or aspire to. Something that happens instantly, something that happens in a peaceful manner, taking your last breath, passing in your sleep. Those are the types of things that we hope for. And then we also know that we don't always get that luxury to choose." So I told him, I said, "Honestly, Gary, I don't know. I said, I hope it's a peaceful one for you." And it was. And it was. So memento mori, remember you are mortal. Remember you're going to die. I thought it would be a humorous segue between our last series on the empire of screens, especially as we just finished talking about AI. There's a headline that caught my eye that I'd saved for this series on death and dying. And perhaps you've heard of this person as well. Brian Johnson is his name. This was from a Wired article in July of 2025 titled, "Brian Johnson is Going to Die." Johnson, a man who worked in tech, made his millions and subsequently embarked on a midlife, post-wealth search for purpose. After selling his web payment company's Braintree for $800 million in 2013, Johnson parted ways with both his wife and his lifelong Mormon religion and announced Project Blueprint, an effort designed to reverse his own body's aging process. This involves an all-consuming, unproven regimen, including daily exercises, blood tests, a strict sleep routine, MRIs, plasma transfers, scalp treatments, urine tests, several dozen supplements, light therapy, and caloric restriction. And I trimmed quite a few out. One of Johnson's three children is infamous for donating his own blood plasma to help his father's anti-aging efforts. And if you look up this story, you'll see pictures of him with his son. And the interviewer, Kate Drummond, she asked this in this article. I just want to read this excerpt. She started out, she said, "I'm going to ask you a very simple true or false question. You can answer however you want. Ready?" Brian Johnson said, "Yes." "True or false? You, Brian Johnson, one day at some point in the future will die." "False," he replies. "Tell me more." He says, "Death has always been inevitable, so we have made all these preparations. We talk about immortality and professional achievements. We talk about life after death. There are the ways that we've dealt with death up until this point, and now we have this very real possibility of extending our lifespans to some unknown horizon. So that extension, that's extension. But we also have the ability to begin moving ourselves to computational systems." You can see where this is starting to tie in with our last series. "So currently, in a very crude form, I have a Brian AI that has digested everything I've ever said." So he wears a device that transcribes everything he says. He's able to talk, and he's able to dictate, and he has this training model on himself that he is doing. But that is just one facet of his way of prolonging death. So the interviewer says, "You currently have this?" "I do," he replied, "and that Brian AI is pretty good. As the technology gets better and better, the most prized asset is going to be existence. Immortality, as we thought about it before, will be devalued relative to existing. And that is my fundamental bet on the future." He's a fascinating individual, and it's quite interesting to see the ways that he is trying to push away the inevitable. And he's fighting death. Meanwhile, the Stoic philosophers of the past tell us that contemplating our very real eventual demise allows us to live a healthy and fruitful life. To embrace death as not something to fight, to run away from, to flee, but to just recognize that it is here. It is a companion to life and very much a natural part of it. And yet we as a culture have very much this sense of discomfort around this subject. Now, some of you have a sense of discomfort because you have experienced trauma around death, and that's normal. I hope you take advantage of therapeutic conversations and modalities to help you make peace with that. As somebody who's experienced both one what I would consider beautiful deaths, I can also think back on my dad who passed during COVID, at the very beginning of COVID. So his final week and a half was in a hospital where we couldn't see him in person, where we're trying to FaceTime him when his phone was charged and he could figure out how to answer it. And we managed to make it in for the final active dying phase of his death where he wasn't responsive. And I look at that and I think also on last night, and I wonder why we have the responses to death that we have, because we don't get to choose the types of death that come when it comes. We all want the ability to be surrounded by our loved ones. We all want the ability to have those last words, to leave that legacy. But it starts by being comfortable with these types of conversation. I will tell you that being able to spend time around death and dying and have these conversations gives you both an appreciation for life, gives you a very wicked sense of like a gallows bedside humor that cannot be appreciated by some, but is almost universal among those who have dealt with death and dying on a repeated basis. The ability to laugh in the face of death and dying, I think, is a very natural healing part. We cried last night and we laughed our butts off at many things that were very inappropriate that if I were to tell you, you would just be confounded. But that's death and that's life, isn't it? There's a lot of cultural differences that I want to start as we're kind of cracking open this nut on our mortality. I want to point out that it's important to recognize where you were born and when you were born very much dictates a lot of the ways or the pre-baked ways that you think about death. Okay, because you were born in an American or in a Western context, you represent a lot of these cultural influences that have been a part of, unfortunately, a growing big funeral business as funeral costs have rampantly grown and the ways that we engage with death have changed in our very lifetime. The fact that we got to spend time with Gary in a home and to take his final breath with him and then to talk about him as he's there and to celebrate his life with a family in a home without being rushed out. This is the way most of human beings have passed for centuries. It's only more recently that hospitals have become a part of this conversation where more and more times we're passing in hospitals and in places like that. But regardless of where it is, there is a way that we think about death that's normal. These are things you do that are normal to do, and these are things that just feel strange. But even those are cultural things that have changed through the years, cremation being one of those ways that things have changed. Last weekend, we celebrated the Day of the Dead. In the Mexican culture, there is an embrace of death that blends the macabre with pictures of skeletons and bright flowers and colors. And it juxtaposes death with life in a rather beautiful way. That's very, very different than our Western culture. In Japan, space constraints, cost, and urbanization dictates a lot of the way that they approach funerals, as well as a Buddhist influence, makes cremation over there nearly universal, 99.9%. Japan is home to a unique custom called shukotsu, a bone collecting. So after the ashes are cremated, the family is given a pair of chopsticks and has the opportunity to sift through the ashes and to pull out the bone fragments and to place them in an urn. I told that to my daughter and she recoiled. That sounds horrific to us, right? And that's a very different culture doing something that feels very normal to them. This is performed after cremation. In Indonesia, one of my favorites, the Manane death ritual in the Tarahu, I believe, region of Indonesia is a unique ceremony where family members, after a person dies, undertake a form of a mummification process. They care for the body in the home, and the body is kept in the home for days and weeks, sometimes multiple months up to 5 to 7 years or longer. This is an intentional act and done with such care as the body is cared for, changed, food is set out, conversation is had, and if grandpa is passed, then you begin caring for your body. And one of the stories told of the kids who spent their lives growing up where grandpa slept in the same bed as they did, and they would wake up and stand them up in the morning, and they would dress them, and they would talk to them about their day and their school. And when those bodies are eventually put to rest, they're placed in these caskets on these burial houses that are these almost like these houses on stilts that can hold 6, 8, 10 caskets. But that's not their final resting place, because about every 3 years or so, there's a festival. And those caskets are brought down, and those old family members are stood back up. They're lovingly brushed off. They're redressed. And it sounds horrible to us. But watching it, and it's fair, watching the care, the attention, the sense that these past loved ones are very much a very real part of their day-to-day life. This ritual reflects the Tarajan belief that death is not an end, but a transition of sorts. The dead continue to live on and maintain a presence. Caitlin Doherty, who's written several books as a, she's a mortician who writes excellently on the subject of death and dying. I highly recommend her book. I'm gonna be quoting her throughout this series. She says, "We consider death rituals savage only when they don't match our own." As she's traveled the world, one of her books, she wrote a book called From Here to Eternity, Traveling the World to Find a Good Death. As she relayed various Western traditions to those in other countries, they would have the same response that we did when we would hear about those. So the way that we approach death and dying is very much dictated by where we've come from. So memento mori, remember you will die. Marcus Aurelius, in his Meditations, I said this is a Stoic reminder, he said, "Let each thing you would do, say, or intend be like that of a dying person." There is something about getting a diagnosis of a terminal disease, because what changes is not the fact that you're going to die. We all know we're going to die. What changes is that it takes this abstract thought about something that's going to happen out in the future, and it brings it into a very real present state. Now that's no longer some distant thought, but a present reality. Now you're thinking about your future, not open-ended, but in terms of years, maybe months. It changes, not the inevitable outcome, but the very present way that we talk about it and think about it. The Stoics say, talking about and contemplating death and our own mortality allows us to live a more full life. If we live, to get very kitsch, like we were dying, as Marcus Aurelius penned before that became a millennial saying that everybody clung to in the early 2000s. Caitlin Doherty said, "Death avoidance is not an individual failing, it's a cultural one. Facing death is not for the faint-hearted. It's far too challenging to expect that each citizen will do this on his or her own." What I'm hoping that we can do in this series is to have some honest, real, thoughtful conversations around this subject and to embrace the sheer depth and diversity of the ways that we die and the ways that we talk about it or not. We had some beautiful conversations in pre-talk this morning, because chances are each of us in this room, to one degree or another, have had or a very close brushed encounter with death. And so we don't have to be reminded that it's an inevitable reality, but we do need some guidance on how we can talk about it in a healthy, healing way. Alan Watts, I love the way that he talks about death and dying and contemplation. The quote that's in your bulletin is one that I use a lot. He said, "Everybody should, in their lifetimes, consider death. Observe skulls and skeletons and wonder what it will be like to go to sleep and never wake up. That is the most gloomy thing for contemplation. It's like manure. Just as manure fertilizes the plants, so the contemplation of death and the acceptance of death is very highly generative of creating life. You'll get wonderful things out of that." Leave it to Watts to reframe death as manure and make even compost sound spiritual. He says this idea of contemplating death is one that can instill such a deep appreciation of the life that we have. And rather than pushing it away, rather than trying to sanitize it as we often do in our Western culture, rather than keeping things behind the closed doors and not thinking about it, to have the same open and honest, real conversations that you would have with an 8, a 10, a 12-year-old as they're asking the kind of questions that one naturally asks about a very natural thing in life. So this contemplation of our mortality, Ellen says, is something that can lead to a very rich, deep appreciation for your life, for where you're at. That article I referenced earlier, Brian Johnson is going to die. I want to read this last question here from the article. Interviewer says, so you're not thinking about your legacy in a 10, a 20, or a 30, or even a 50-year time frame. You're thinking about hundreds of years. Brian responds, it's the only time that makes sense to me. I did a thought experiment where I imagined being present in the 25th century. I'm sitting with them, and they're talking in whatever form they're talking, and they're looking back on the early 21st century. So if they do that, what do they say? I've thought about this question for years. One, this is his conclusion, one, they would say that was when humanity gave birth to superintelligence. Two, that was when humanity figured out that they were the first generation who wouldn't die. To reiterate the title of that article, Brian Johnson is going to die. I appreciate his efforts and the money he's throwing at it. But I wonder how many people, if given the chance, would claw so desperately to life like him instead of appreciating. You see, Brian Johnson sees death as a problem to solve, and the Stoics and the Buddhists and the mystics see death as a truth to befriend, not a problem to be solved. Something to embrace. Death is not the opposite of life. It's a part of it. When we face our impermanence with honesty, with curiosity, fears begin to soften, and gratitude deepens, and life itself takes on new hues, new colors of vitality as we appreciate the gift of this present moment, the gift of this next breath, as there are those around this world taking their very last at the same moment. That's the beauty of life. That's the beauty of this planet that we exist on. And that's something that we're going to embrace, contemplate, and celebrate. Memento mori. Remember your mortality. But also to include the second part of that phrase that the Stoics would add, memento vivere, remember now to live. That remembering you're going to die should prompt a greater appreciation and use of the life that we have. Thank you. Let's have Scott and Mallory come back up and add some of their wonderful, unique musical perspective to conversations like this. I'm so grateful for the artists that we have in our community that are connected to us to do these kind of things. Music has been a wonderful part of this whole process, so thank you.